And welcome to the Sunday Salon, the podcast that celebrates brilliant books and the women who write them. I'm not sure you could have come up with a more ambitious task than Kat Arney set herself when she decided to write her most recent book, Rebel Cell, Cancer, Evolution and the Science of Life. In it, she looks at the history of cancer in human race, as well as how we tend to view, prevent and treat it today, and what the future holds. It's not her first massive challenge. Before this, she wrote a book explaining how genes work. I loved hearing how she takes on these tasks, as well as how she built her career in science and science communication, a frequently male-dominated field, as well as what it's been like to have science become the focus of so much attention over the past year. I hope you find her as fascinating as I did. Kat, welcome to the Sunday Salon. Thank you so much for coming on. I'm so excited to talk to you.
Thank you for having me. No, this is a real pleasure. Thanks.
So, as you know, there's lots that I want to try and cover with you. But before I do, we're recording remotely, as I've been doing basically the whole year now. How has it been? How has sort of lockdown and not lockdown and all the different kind of semi-lockdowns, how have they been?
So I was so excited about 2020 at the beginning of the year because, you know, I knew I was going to have a book coming out. I'm also running my own business and it's kind of growing and I was really excited. In January, I was in Thailand delivering a workshop, a science communication workshop. And I was like, this is brilliant. And then I was speaking at a conference in Belgium. I was like, this is brilliant. And that was March. But at the same time, you know, I was working on a report for a client that was all about vaccination and speaking to all these respiratory disease experts. And they were like, this is going to be bad. So from sort of the beginning of March, February, it was like, oh, I think January, you know, I think January is a long way away now. And I think 2020 is not going to pan out. And since then, it's just actually been crazy. I've been very lucky to be working really hard. You know, science communication, which is the business that I run, is apparently a hot topic now. Who knew?
It's interesting. You mentioned there, you know, science communication being front and centre of our minds at the moment. Has it been gratifying for you as an expert in that field to see science, I suppose, become of interest to so many people? Or has it been sort of frustrating in times to see how people can, I suppose, deploy selective evidence or statistics to suit whatever their own sort of, I suppose, political and ideological position is?
Yeah, it's definitely a lot of motivated reasoning going on out there. I've sort of got two feelings about this. On the one hand, it's absolutely wild to me to see so many people talking about R0 values and T cells. And, you know, I think it's absolutely incredible that the jump in scientific literacy that so many people have made and statistical literacy and all these kind of things, I think has been incredible. And a lot of that has been driven by really phenomenal work by the UK science journalist, science communication community has just done absolutely stellar work, just slamming out explainers. Now, for our part, we're working with the COVID symptom study app, which is run by Tim Spector and his colleagues at King's College and Zoe. And so we've just been nonstop trying to explain what's going on with the app, all the data, the research that's coming out of it. And it's just been phenomenal to see people really grasp that, understand it, and then share it. So that's been very gratifying. But at the same time, I really do think the pandemic has just accelerated and magnified all the issues that we already knew were there in science communication. You know, do you publicize preprints, which are kind of pre-peer-reviewed papers? They're basically PDFs that people put on sites on the internet. But because it takes so long to actually publish peer-reviewed work, you know, the journals are doing a really good job of making it faster and accelerating it. But, you know, people need answers now and people are publishing preprints. And so, you know, journalists, communicators are talking about them. And there's this whole argument going on about it. And also, you know, that there are divides and there are absolutely legitimate discussions and arguments in science. Like, that's how science works. We gather evidence, we weigh it, we discuss, we go, all right, well, you know, it could be this, could be that. What experiments do we need to do next to build the evidence base? I think there's been a lot of discussions about what does being led by the science actually mean, because I think people are having to confront this idea that science is just this fixed edifice that can just tell you things, like some kind of magic eight ball, like the science says, don't go out. Like, that's not how it works. Science is a process. It's not a product. You know, it's not something that's just fixed and immovable. It's a process of understanding and gathering evidence to figure out how the world works. And that, I think, we're really having to grapple with. And a lot of science communicators and science journalists were kind of, you know, going like, this is a problem. People are not really getting this. And I've been banging this drum for ages, but suddenly it's just shoved in our faces. When you can open Twitter and there's like professors just having massive full-on arguments about this paper or that paper and masks or not masks and this and that. And I, wow, science has basically got all its dirty laundry out right now and everyone's just ruffling through it.
Can I just rewind to ask you a bit of background about how you kind of got into this field? I mean, can you just tell me a little bit about your childhood? Were you always interested in science as a child? Do you, I mean, you come from quite a scientific family and that your sister is also a scientist. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, so I'm one of those kind of nerdy kids. I've always been fascinated by nature and science. I kept snails when I was little. You know, I had a chemistry set and all that kind of thing and did all the science subjects at school. Not terribly good at maths and physics. That's always been my bugbear. But just fascinated particularly about biology, the life sciences, chemistry. Like, how does life work? You know, in the UK, we're kind of forced down into quite narrow routes. Certainly, at least when I was choosing my A-levels, you had to basically do, you could do science or arts. I did music as well. And that basically meant I lost my afternoon on Wednesday when everyone else got to do sport and go bowling and things like that. But yeah, you're kind of forced into this quite narrow thing. And yeah, went to university, did science, did a PhD because I was going to become a scientist. You know, I'm going to be a professor one day. So you do your degree, you do your PhD, did a short postdoc, which was probably a big mistake. And really over that process of being a researcher, realized that, you know, I love science. Like, I love the discovery and the ideas and the concepts. And, you know, I just love DNA. It's a beautiful molecule, and how our genes work and how they unfold to create life is incredible to me. And I just want to know more about it and tell people about it. But actually doing research really wasn't working out for me. Like, I'm really clumsy. I've got a really short attention span. The kind of branch of science I was working in, I was working with like really delicate mouse embryos and all this kind of stuff. And it was very, very difficult and stressful. And I became sort of very depressed because all my life I'd thought, I'm going to be a scientist, one day I'll be a professor, and yeah. And suddenly realizing in my, you know, mid-20s that I was a failure. That's really what it felt like. You know, you've been trained as a scientist, done all this stuff, and feeling like I was a failure at this thing that I was meant to do. So that was a big kind of turning point, and realizing that actually I did do other things. I loved writing. I loved reading. I loved communicating. I loved all the stuff I was doing at the time in public engagement, you know, going, doing schools events and public events and writing about science and starting to discover that there was a career there. And this is back in the days before there was like YouTube. None of that stuff existed. Mm-hmm. There weren't really podcasts. But, you know, blogging was starting to become a thing and lots more stuff on the internet, science writing on the internet. And that's really where I kind of grew a career in science communication, went to work at Cancer Research UK in 2004, spent 12 years there doing all kinds of SciComms things, which was just really amazing place to work. And then went freelance in 2016 when my first book came out, Herding Hemingway's Cats, which is sort of an exploration of how our genes work. Turns out it's really complicated. And then I went freelance, had a bit of a wild couple of years. Yeah. In the space of about a year and a half, I quit my job, went freelance, left my husband, and turned 40. And so that was a ride, that kind of that time. And then a couple of years ago, set up a company, First Create the Media, because I realized that, you know, there was just so much more I could do if I was bringing people with me and building a little team to actually do, you know, bigger and better jobs and working with organizations, charities, institutes, companies that are doing amazing science and helping to explain it to the world. So it's been a pretty wild ride, I'd say, particularly the last few years has been incredible.
And can I ask about being a woman in science? I mean, we often hear about the kind of dearth of women in so-called STEM subjects. And I mean, every now and then some story will appear about sexism in the science industry. I mean, the one that always springs to mind is that sort of the kind of distractingly sexy fiasco where we had a male scientist sort of talk about how women were distractingly sexy if they were in the labs. Have you experienced any sexism? I mean, have you felt that your gender has impacted your career?
So for me, I think it's interesting being in the biological sciences and particularly being in things like sort of embryology and developmental biology that's quite female heavy. So it's broadly been sort of, you know, you go to conferences and there's much more of a mix. I mean, also, I haven't been a practicing scientist for quite some time now. There was one really interesting bit in when I was a PhD student. So my supervisor was a man. It's quite a big lab. And we all had to clean the lab every month because, you know, labs get messy. And so we'd all stop for a couple of hours in the afternoon and clean the lab. But if the men in the lab had important experiments to do, they were allowed to not have to do the cleaning. And I was like, excuse me. I hope that things have got better. And I've had amazing, like the last woman I worked for, Mandy Fisher, she was just incredible woman, mentor, supporter of my failing career and my move into science comm. So, you know, I think I've had a mix of experiences. One of the interesting things I've had has not necessarily been because I've been a woman, but has been because I was short, which is also a function of being a woman generally. But I distinctly remember at a conference, there's this whole thing of poster sessions where you put your research on a poster and you stand in front of it with a glass of warm wine and people come around and either ignore you or ask you questions. And I remember, because I'm only 5 feet tall, there were two kind of tall male professors talking about my poster literally over my head. Just talking to each other over my head. And I, oh my God, this is just, you know, I'm down here, guys. You could ask me. So that's been a bit weird. I think in things like the physical sciences, maths, technology, physics, I think the sort of, they are still really grappling. And then there's the wider question of diversity, you know, white women doing pretty good in some areas of science. More diversity in terms of sort of the ethnic makeup and racial makeup of science still needs a lot more work. You know, I think my personal experiences have been not too bad, but I have definitely seen it and listening to other women's stories. And I think also the pandemic has, again, really accelerated and magnified the problems of women in many fields, but particularly in science. You know, we've seen evidence that women are publishing fewer papers during this time. They're having to balance childcare and teaching and all this kind of stuff. So I think it's been very, very, very difficult.
And can I just ask about your sort of choice of subject matter? These are really sort of huge subjects. Your choice of subject matter for books, genetics, cancer. How do you go about deciding to focus on something like that? And then, I mean, how do you even begin to go about researching a book like that that has such a sort of sweeping scope?
I'm fascinated by life. Ever since I was a PhD student, the kind of research area that I was in was trying to answer the question, like, how do you go from a single cell, a fertilized egg, with one set of DNA? You know, you get some DNA from mum, some DNA from dad, you've got one single fertilized egg, and you unfold life out of that. It absolutely blows my mind. Like, when you really sit and think about it, you've got one cell, it divides into two cells, four cells, eight cells, it becomes a little football of cells. From just this process of cell proliferation, genes being turned on, genes being turned off, cells interpreting all the information that's coming into them from inside, from outside, making decisions, specializing, living, dying, dividing, you turn one cell into a baby. And whether that's a baby human, a baby mouse, a baby worm, a baby frog, like, how on earth does that work? It's mind-boggling. And, you know, I, in my PhD, in my research, I never got very far into understanding that because it turns out it's really complicated. But that fundamental question of, like, how on earth does that work? That drove my first book, Herding Hemingway's Cats, really, which the sort of the story behind the title is that I was sitting in a conference and someone was talking about the Hemingway cats. And these are the cats that have thumbs. So, you know, you might know them as mitten cats or whatever. And, you know, Ernest Hemingway had them on his estate down in Florida. And the genetic change that gives these cats thumbs is basically like a single letter of DNA. We have 6 billion letters of DNA in the genome. It's a single letter of DNA that's changed. And it's miles away in DNA terms from the actual gene. And I was like, wow, you know, how does that all work? And in order to kind of unfold that journey, for me, it's always been like, right, I'm going to, well, for a start, read loads of papers because I like reading, and then also go and talk to people. So I went on this journey talking to all kinds of scientists all over the world, like Nobel Prize winners, all sorts of researchers. We're like, how do our genes work? And pretty much all of them were like, well, when you find out, let me know. So that first book was just sort of unpacking what we do and what we don't know about genetics. And yeah, it's a massive topic, very complicated. So for my second book, I thought I would narrow down and just tackle cancer, but then realized it was the same thing. It's like development is one cell, normal cell, growing into a baby. Cancer is one abnormal cell growing into a cancer. And it's suddenly realizing that these are just mirror processes and really understanding that as sort of this evolutionary expanding journey. And again, I did the same kind of thing, sat down, talked to loads of researchers, did a lot of reading, did a lot of thinking. It was just incredible to put all this stuff together and then had to launch the book in the middle of a pandemic. So yeah.
You write that one in two people in the UK born after 1960 are predicted to get cancer at some point in their lifetime. But one of the things that I hadn't really known about at all was the debates that are occurring over kind of how far back we can trace cancer in humans. And you write about a few kind of high profile examples, but one of them is, I think it's Kangan Man. Is that the correct pronunciation? I'm not sure. Can you just tell me a bit about that and about those debates and sort of where we think kind of cancer first began to emerge?
When I started writing this book, I was drawing a lot on my experiences at Cancer Research UK. So a lot of what I did when I was there was answering inquiries from the public, going out and doing talks, hearing questions, all that kind of thing. And one of the questions that we would get a lot was framed around the idea that basically cancer is a modern disease. It's to do with our modern toxic lifestyles. And that's why there's so much cancer nowadays. And if we could just remove all these modern toxic things, then we would have no more cancer. And really, I wanted to kind of bust that as a myth, because cancer is not a new disease and it's not just a human disease. And the more I started looking into it, like I kind of knew, yeah, we knew that cancer has been found in dinosaur fossils and ancient remains, but the extent to which that is true, and the thing that particularly blew my mind is the extent to which over the whole tree of life, you can find examples of cancer in pretty much any animal species you look at. It's mind-blowing. Like, cancer is just a deep biological phenomenon. And going back and looking at all the evidence of cancer in ancient humans, in ancient specimens, a 250-million-year-old turtle fossil with a cancer. The very week my book came out in the UK, there was a new announcement of a 70-million-year-old dinosaur fossil with a tumour. And it's like, this is a deep, deep ancient disease. So it's not just human and it's not just modern. But at the same time, I've had people like, well, you know, if you can't avoid it, then why bother do anything at all? It's like, well, no, there are things that we know do increase the risk of cancer. And one of the most frustrating things is aging. We can't do anything about that. Like, your risk of cancer goes up as you get older. And that's kind of hardwired into our evolution as a species. So that was something quite challenging to have to grapple with in the book. And also as someone, you know, currently crashing through her 40s, was, you know, coming to terms with my own, you know, risk and my own mortality was an interesting one. But yeah, we do know that this is a really deep fundamental process in biology. And if I can do anything in this book, it's kind of taking away that blame that I think a lot of people feel like, oh, you must have done something. You know, what caused it? You did something to bring this upon you, or something was done to you to bring this upon you. And it's like, it's much more complicated than that. We've got this combination of deep biology, the world around us, a bit of bad luck. And the other thing that I found really amazing writing the book is actually, you know, you said that statistic about one in two people will get cancer in their lifetime. And you're like, my God, that's incredibly common. That's bad. But on an individual level, cancer is incredibly rare. And this seems like a really wildly controversial statement. But just think about it. Your body is made of trillions of cells. They divide billions and billions of times in your lifetime. And the latest research shows that, like, as we age, we are just a patchwork of mutations. Like, all your cells have seen some stuff. They all have the capacity to go wrong. And some of them are going wrong in their own kind of way. And many of them have the kind of genetic changes that if we found them in a cancer, we would say that's a cancer change. But each one of us will only develop maybe one, maybe two new actual cancers in our lifetime. So it's like a one in a 10 with 14 zeros probability after it. Like, it's the world's most shitty lottery is the way I explain it. So, like, we should be amazed how cancer resistant our bodies are, that they get us most of the way through life, through all the kind of the stresses, the strains, the damage that happens to our tissues. Like, our biology is absolutely incredible about how it protects us from cancer. And we need to understand how that works. We don't tend to study why we stay healthy. As scientists, we tend to only fixate on, like, what's gone wrong. But yeah, I think more understanding about what does healthy tissue look like, it's kind of pretty messed up. So how does it not go wrong? So that was a really interesting avenue to explore in the book, for sure.
And can you explain on that point the role of genetics and DNA in affecting, I suppose, probabilities and also, you know, the potency of lifestyle factors when it comes to sort of causation?
So this was another interesting thing. So having written my first book about genetics, it's all about genetics and how our genes work. And when I sat down to write my new book, Rebel Cell, you know, it's called Cancer, Evolution and the Science of Life, I was expecting to write about cancer genetics. Yeah, we've had huge progress in understanding the genetic changes that underpin cancer in recent years. You know, DNA sequencing has got faster and cheaper, and you can look down in, like, tiny little pockets of cells and understand all the genetic changes that are in there. And we've got this whole new way of treating cancer by looking at the genetic changes in a tumor and then picking the right kind of drugs that will work on that cancer. Spoilers, turns out it's probably a lot harder than that. You have to read the book to find that one out. But I was just expecting to be writing a lot about the role of genetics and all these changes in cancer. And then as I started to really get into researching and talking to people, you realize, like, the genetics and the mutations, like, they're important, but they're not that important, because loads of your cells, all your normal cells, are full of genetic changes and mutations. So it's not just enough to have these genetic changes to drive a cancer. And you realize that it's more an issue of tissue. Like, it's how our, it's this, the concept of, like, you know, being more holistic. I hate that word because it's been kind of captured by alternative medicine, but, like, understanding how your cells are acting in the ecology of your body and your tissue. So this idea of understanding, like, what causes cancer, what enables cancers to emerge, it's not just about understanding what causes these changes, these mutations. And we do know a lot about that. We know, you know, the two most obvious ones are things like the chemicals in tobacco smoke and UV light from the sun and all sorts of nasty environmental chemicals that we know damage DNA. But it's also about, well, what do we know about what keeps our tissues healthy to control cells that are damaged and stop them going out of control? Because your body is full of cells that are damaged and going out of control, but they're not turning into cancer. And so that's where you start to get into the interesting lifestyle thing about, well, what is the role of physical activity in reducing inflammation and keeping our tissues healthy? What is the role of the changes, the physiological changes in the body that are caused by excess body fat? You know, body fat is not inert. It's causing biological changes and hormonal changes in the body and releasing all sorts of chemicals that may increase inflammation in our tissues. So, you know, it's not just as simple as saying, well, if you don't smoke, you won't get cancer. If you eat vegetarian diet, you won't get cancer. It's like, it's a lot more complicated than that. And there's a lot we don't understand about actually, how do we keep our bodies healthy? How is this actually working on a tissue level? And then, you know, what can we do to encourage that and help to keep our tissues kind of buff and healthy for as long as possible? So it's a new way of thinking about cancer prevention. It's not just about the mutations. I mean, obviously, don't add to your mutational load unless you can help it. But it is also about keeping your tissues kind of as young and healthy for as long as possible.
Can I ask about the feedback you've had? Because, again, in some ways, it's this sort of juxtaposition of kind of hope, but also the sort of cold, hard reality, I mean, of not dealing in absolutes. I mean, the kind of war on cancer type approaches of, you know, eradicating all cancers that you take issue with. Have you found that some people have reacted negatively to that, found it sort of depressing or not?
I've actually had overwhelmingly positive responses, which has been really nice. I was very nervous putting the book out about how patients would react. That was something that really, really worried me, because you know that people affected by cancer, people whose loved ones are affected by cancer, are going to be reading this book, and balancing that message of, like, I think some of the things that we do around treating cancer and detecting cancer are not really working very well, that we need to think again in many cases, and balancing that message with, like, we still have made amazing progress, and that you should, you know, your doctor is doing the best that they can now with the evidence and the information that we have available. In terms of general responses, it's been really nice that people have said things like, I've never read a book about cancer like this in a good way. I think it's a lot of books about cancer are sort of can be memoirs, you know, very personal memoirs and personal stories and very emotional, or they can be just very dry and standing back and, you know, very, very factual. And I've tried to write something that is really engaging about a biological process. It's about a profusion of life, but in a terrible way. And that comes back to the idea of, like, well, can we declare war on cancer? It's like, well, you may as well declare war on multicellularity or war on evolution, because cancer is a deep biological process that's born out of us being multicellular beings that live on a planet that where the process of evolution by natural selection is what gives all the diversity of life on Earth, but also drives the process of cancer evolution in your body. So this idea that we'll one day wake up and live in a world where there is absolutely no cancer ever and we have eradicated it forever, it's just a fiction. You know, maybe we can get to a point where we really understand what makes cancer emerge out of the tissues of our bodies, that combination of mutations and tissue disruption, and we can push it so far back in our lifetimes that it effectively doesn't shorten human lifespan. And certainly, you know, doing things to understand and treat cancers in children as well, because cancers in children are very, very different to cancers in adults. Those really are genetically driven diseases. They're sort of genetic alterations that cause problems in development in different parts of the body. So that's a very, very different thing to cancers in adults and needs understanding and treating differently. But yeah, I think, you know, this idea that we will live in a world without any cancer is a fiction, but I am really hopeful that we can live in a world where cancer does not shorten human lifespans and does not, you know, it does not steal mums, daughters, dads, brothers, aunts, uncles, you know, the people that we love from us before their time. And that's really where I'd like people to take away from the book, that there is hope that we can get to that place, I think, but we do need to change the way that we think about a lot of aspects of cancer.
And before I let you go, I just need to ask one final question, which I ask everyone who comes on the podcast, which is, if you could go back and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be?
I've been thinking about this, and the mantra would be, like, this is for you. So there's been a lot of times in my life when I've sort of had that feeling like, oh, that's not for you. You know, can you really do that? It's not for you. And certainly, like, now running a company has been something I've never done before, never really expected to be doing. I didn't, you know, I don't really identify as someone who is a business lady, but it's like, no, there's no reason why this cannot be for you. Like, there's nothing intrinsic in any of us that's like, you can or can't do this. The other thing is that a couple of years ago, I really made the commitment in my life to live my life like a mediocre white man with that kind of level of confidence. Like, yeah, I can do this. And it's really working out for me. So I can't tell you what a difference that made. It's like, no, you can do this. This can be for you. You can change. You can try things. And if it doesn't work out, you can. That was the other thing as well. Like, failure is not fatal. Failure is information about you tried something, it didn't work. What are you going to try next? I think that would also be a really important piece of advice. I'm very much like someone who was one of those irritating straight A students at school, and my entire personal validation was based around like getting straight A's. And then you become a grown up and you're like, oh, no one's going to give me A's for anything anymore. How do I validate myself? So yeah, definitely going back and telling my younger self, like, you need to work out ways that aren't straight A's and your mother's validation about how you think that you're going forward in the world would be very useful, I think. It's taken me a long time to figure that one out.
Well, there were several very, very good pieces of advice in there. So thank you, Kat. That's a terrific note to end on. I really appreciate you coming on the podcast, and it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you. And to everyone listening, Rebel Cell, Cancer, Evolution, and the Science of Life is out now. So that's it from us. Thank you very much for listening to the Sunday Salon. Please do share your thoughts about the episode with me. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Alice Azania. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please do think about leaving a rating or review. I really enjoy reading them, and it really helps the podcast's success in the charts. So until next week, thank you very much and goodbye.